Well, good morning. The reason he's led one song is I have about 2 hours worth of things to say. No, I appreciate him leading that one song. He's going to lead a couple more songs interspersed throughout this sermon this morning. So that's why he's doing that. But it is good to be here. We're thankful for your presence. If you're visiting, thank you so much for being here and stick around so that we can get to know you a little bit better. Our text this morning is going to be Exodus chapter 19. You're welcome to turn there. That's not where I'm going to begin, but we will be there momentarily. But when God created the world in Genesis chapters 1 and 2, God created a very special place that he called the Garden of Eden. And that text tells us two very important key ideas. First of all, the garden was located on a mountain. In Genesis chapter 2 and verse 10, it says a river flowed out of Eden to water the garden, and there it divided and became four rivers. These rivers were the Pishon, Gihon, Tigris, and Euphrates. Another passage, if that's not, doesn't suffice for you as proof that there's a mountain, that this was on a mountain, Ezekiel 28, 13 through 16 tells us that the Garden of Eden was the holy mountain of God. So this is a mountain. Another thing the Garden of Eden was a temple. And this was God's temple. In Genesis chapter 3 and verse 8, we are told that they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden. And you may be familiar with this from the Ephesians class, but that word walking is used of God three other times, specifically in reference to God and the temple or the tabernacle. So Leviticus 26, 12, it says, "And I will walk among you and will be your God." In Deuteronomy 23 and verse 14, it says, "Because the Lord your God walks in the midst of your camp, therefore your camp must be holy." And then 2 Samuel 7, where David wants to build the temple, God tells him, "No, your son will do that." He says here, "I have not lived in a house since the day I brought up the people of Israel from Egypt to this day, but I have been moving about in a tent for my dwelling." That Hebrew word moving, it's the same word walk in Genesis. And so what you find is that God resided in a temple on a mountain. And he graciously created Adam and Eve to share this sanctuary with. In fact, they were given priestly duties to guard and to keep the garden, to keep the wickedness out of God's presence. And so you begin to realize that holiness is at the core of being with God. But we're left wondering a little bit here, is God ever going to reside with his people again? Because we know what happened to Adam and Eve. They didn't keep the wickedness out and they were kicked out of the garden. Will they ever be able to reside on the mountain of God ever again? And what's interesting is that as you keep reading the story of the Bible, as you go through Genesis, it becomes clear that God starts appearing on mountains. People like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And at the beginning of Exodus, God calls to Moses from a burning bush on a mountain, Mount Horeb. What's God doing? Well, I think he's reminding us that he hasn't forgotten what things were like before we made a mess of things. And that he is going to fix our sins and restore us to himself. And the first major story where we see this take place is Exodus 19. So here in Exodus 19, verses 1 through 4, we have this a scene of a gracious God. They've been in slavery, Israel has, for 430 years. God says it's time to liberate them. He frees them so they could serve him. And this is how he describes their salvation in verse 4. "You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself." Well, God leaves no room for Israel to boast in anything. He brought them out by his strength, like the king of the birds would carry her young on her back. Now, Israel, of course, trusted that God would lead them over on dry ground from the Red Sea, but God leaves no doubt that their salvation was God's work alone. And he did this to bring them to himself. I'm going to refer back to the Ephesians class again. You remember what Paul said in Ephesians 2, that we were helpless and we were dead, but God, rich in mercy, made us alive. And so we put our faith in God's work of baptism when he raised us up to be with him. But this is God's saving work. And he saved us so that we might do good works. And so notice that's what God tells Israel next here in chapter 19 and verse 5 and 6. They were saved for good works. This is what he says. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant. Those are the works that they are to do. And I just want to stop here for a moment just to say that God never intended Israel to see the law as works that they had to do for God to save them. God says, I've already saved you. Now go and obey and keep my covenant. Why? Because the law was intended to make them like God, to make them holy like he was. The impetus for obeying God was not to get things. It was to get God. And if they obeyed, it would radically transform who they were. So notice what they are in verses 5 through 6. He says, if you obey, you'll be my treasured possession. Now that is a very specific Hebrew word that meant the personal wealth of the king. In those days, kings owned it all. But there were specific parts of their treasure that were special to them, and they kept it locked in their chamber so that only they could open it up and look at it. And that's what he says Israel was to be to them if they obeyed. You will be my special treasure that I keep locked in my chamber. I think what God is doing is he's saying, actually, I want us to treasure each other. And that's how marriage works, isn't it? You find out what pleases your spouse, and you go out and you do those things for her, for him. God says, you needed saving, and I did that because I love you. Now I want you to delight in me and do the things that please me. Obey my voice. Christianity is about treasuring the one who treasures us. He also says obedience would make them a kingdom of priests. They have come from the lowest place to the highest place in royalty. They've been consecrated to the service of God, to dedicate to the ministering of the needs of the people. That's what this means to be a priest. And then he says, if you obey, you also become a holy people. In other words, God says, if you do what I've asked of you, if you obey and listen to me, you will become a royal kingdom whose hallmark of existence is holiness. You will be distinctively different. And so obedience, kids, Jackson, listen to this. Obedience is linked to gratitude and transformation. You want to be like God? Obey his voice. And at this point, they agree to the terms. And God says in verse 9, I'm coming to you in a thick cloud, which, by the way, is interesting. In the ancient world, if you wanted to find the gods, you went up to the very top of the temple, you offered a sacrifice and hoped to find the gods. God doesn't work that way. You never find God, he always finds you. And so he's going to come down. And so they wash, they cleanse themselves, and then they behold this terrifying and unapproachable God, and yet he approaches. Notice with me here in verse 16. On the morning of the third day, there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud on the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast, so that all the people in the camp trembled. Then Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and he took their stand at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke because the Lord had descended on it in fire. The smoke of it went up like the smoke of a kiln. And the whole mountain trembled greatly. And as the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke and God answered him in thunder. The Lord came down on Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. And the Lord said to Moses, go down and warn the people, lest they break through to the Lord to look, and many of them perish. Also let the priests who come near to the Lord consecrate themselves, lest the Lord break out against them. In verse 23, Moses says, the people cannot come up to Mount Sinai. For you yourselves warned us, saying, set limits around the mountain and consecrate it. Now, I want you to appreciate something that God has done to this mountain. I've tried to illustrate that up here on this picture. This mountain assumes the character of a sanctuary. The summit is the inner sanctum, or the Holy of Holies. This is where God says, I've come down to reside, in verse 18. It's also where he invites Moses to come up, in verse 20. Halfway up the mountain is the outer sanctum, the holy place. This is perhaps where the priests were allowed to reside, in verse 22, depending on how you take this. And then there is the foot of the mountain, which is the outer court. This is where the people would come, but of course they couldn't touch or they would die. Just as the garden on a mountain of God was his dwelling, Mount Sinai has now become his dwelling place. And this must have been an incredible scene. The deep darkness, the gloom, the storms, thunder and lightning, trumpet blasts, this loud voice. The Hebrew writer that was just read for us in chapter 12 of Hebrews says that Moses was saying, I tremble with fear. I mean, I would have been so scared that my first thought was, my mind is telling my legs to go and run, but they couldn't have. I would have been so frozen. You get the feeling that God is not a Santa Claus that you can sit on and ask for anything that you want. Why did Moses respond this way? Why did the people respond this? Why were they so terrified? And the short answer is, he is holy. Maybe you're thinking, well, can you tell us something we don't know? I mean, that's obvious here. But here's the deal. And I'm just going to speak for myself, but I think I'm in denial a lot about how bad my sins must seem to a holy God. We know the right thing to say. I'm a sinner, and I need God's grace. But I think I say that more confidently than I believe it sometimes. But here's the flip side of this. Maybe it is the grace of God that keeps me from fully comprehending what my sins are like to him. Let me put it another way. Dr. Keller put it this way. If I truly grasped the cowardly, rebellious person I am, I think I would die. He speaks of a counselor at an Ivy League school who was meeting these students that were coming into these Ivy League schools for their first year. And what's interesting is she says that once they got into school, after the first month or two, it was a train wreck for them. Because this whole time, they've got nothing but A's their whole life. They think they're the smartest person in town. And in fact, now that they're in here, they're like, oh, there are other smart people. They're smarter than I am. And the professors are under a huge pressure to give them all A's because they know if they don't, they won't be able to handle the emotional stress. If it is difficult to measure up to human standards, what do you think it must be like to get near God? Israel almost died. Maybe somebody says, well, let's just take away the auditory and the visual effects. I doubt they'd be afraid then, and I would beg to differ with you. You remember Phil is doing a series right now on the Sermon on the Mount. That is another mountain scene where we see God's Son on the mountain, and what is it that he's teaching people? Be perfect as God is perfect. One more example that's fascinating. A college professor was teaching at a major university, and she gave her students an assignment. She said, I want you to read the Sermon on the Mount, and I want you to give me a report on what you think of it. And this is what some of her students said. "I did not like this Sermon on the Mount. It made me feel like I had to be perfect, and no one is. The things asked in this sermon are absurd. To look at a woman like that is adultery. To be angry is like murder. These are the most extreme, stupid, unhuman statements I have ever heard." That's honesty. They're trying to hide. They'd love for people to live like that around them, but they know they cannot live up to this standard. And this professor said that these students were just reading this with open eyes, had never really read this before, and it terrified them. This is why God was terrifying to Israel. They saw themselves when they beheld God, and yet he's still approaching. Not on his full scale of glory. He shrouds that with a cloud because he didn't want to harm them. And yet even that made them tremble. Now this certainly isn't Adam and Eve's experience prior to the fall, but he's getting closer. And he's getting closer to make things right. So I want us to sing a song here about standing in awe of God. I've asked Jay to lead that for us.
You are beautiful beyond description to your mind.
So how can God be both fire and cloud? Be 100% holy and yet 100% love? How can he be satisfied? It's a mediator. That's essentially what Moses is in this story, right? He's trying to present God to the people, and he's trying to present the people to God. But do you remember what it is that he says to God? He says, "I can't get the people up here to you. I can't do it." So turn to Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12. Verse 18, this was our scripture reading this morning. "For you have not come to what may be touched, the blazing fire and darkness and gloom and a tempest and the sound of a trumpet and a voice whose words may the hearers beg that no further messages be spoken to them. For they could not endure the order that was given. If even a beast touches the mountain, it shall be stoned. Indeed, so terrifying was the sight that Moses said, 'I tremble with fear.' But you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to innumerable angels in festal gathering, and to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect." and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. Do you notice the difference between Mount Zion and Mount Sinai? What's missing? It's a fear factor. They trembled. They were scared for their lives. But we come to the mountain of God without dread and without fear. Why? Because the mediator Jesus did what Moses did not do and couldn't do. There's another mountain scene that we find in Matthew chapter 27. On this mountain, we find Jesus with his arms spread wide. And this is what it says. Verse 45, I'm going to skip through some of these verses, but verse 45, now from the sixth hour there was darkness over all the land until the ninth hour. And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, that is my God, why have you forsaken me? In verse 50, Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. And behold, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and the earth shook. The rocks were split. The tombs were opened. Many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. Verse 54, when the centurion and those who were with him, keeping watch over Jesus, saw the earthquake and what took place, they were filled with awe and said, truly, this was the Son of God. Do you see what God did to fix our sin problem so that we could be on that mountain with him again? So that we could walk with God? Jesus symbolically touched the mountain of Sinai. It would have put us to death. It put Jesus to death. He took on our darkness. He took on the storms, the lightning, and the flashes of thunder, the earthquake. He yelled out with a loud voice so that we could come to the throne room of God with confidence. Let's sing about that. After we sing this song, I will offer the invitation, and then we will have our invitation song.
Before the throne of God above, I have a strong and a perfect plea, a great high priest whose name is love, whoever lives and pleads for me. My name is
Thank you, Jay, for leading these songs, just helping us reflect on what a holy and powerful God we serve and what he has done so that we can experience that. The song that we're about to sing is not a typical invitation song. It's called Surround Us, Lord. But it reminds us that through Christ that we can enjoy the embrace of God, what Israel struggled to do fully. He surrounds us much better than any mountain ever could. And if we will only put our trust in God's work of salvation, being buried with him in baptism, he will draw us to himself, and he will take us up to the mountain to dwell with him forever. If there's any way that we can help you this morning, we ask that you come now as we stand and sing.